Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday morning show, the top of November, with hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Phil. How are you today?
Good. And you?
Well, a little damp and tired of this rain, but other than that, fine.
Well, we did a lot of yard work, built a big fire to keep the chill away, and got some of the slash burned.
Very good. And I got out and tried to do a little hiking to keep my spirits up and cooked.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about the weather first, and then we have an exciting guest. Do you want to describe our guest at least, Julie?
Well, I sure do. Our guest this morning is Richard Kuhnel, and he is a sustainable living practitioner who lives here in Sandpoint. Morning, Richard.
Good morning.
We'll be talking with you shortly.
Thank you.
So we have a 100% chance of rain, which seems accurate since it's raining right now today. It's going to hit a high of about 46 degrees. Then tonight, the chances of rain and patchy showers decrease to about 30% with a low of 39. We're edging down there. Wednesday, we have patchy fog, then mostly cloudy, a high of 49. So it looks like a little bit of break in the clouds until Wednesday night when the rain comes back. Low of 39. And then Thursday, a chance of rain with a chance of some sun, too.
Well, isn't that exciting? I won't have to go down and look in my crawl space that morning.
Yeah, it looks like this is the rainiest October on record for the area. At least Spokane broke some records. And I know from certain friends' backyard rain gauges, we were hitting close to 12 inches here.
This is what I've heard. That's It's really something.
Yeah. But rain makes things grow, right, Richard?
Absolutely. Yeah. We love the rain.
That's right. Well, Richard, I'd like to reintroduce you again. You're here to join us, Richard Kuhnel, and you live in Sandpoint. And you are a sustainable living practitioner. And I think you know something about our topic for this morning, which is going to be mainly around gardening and the concepts of permaculture. So why don't you take a minute and tell us about yourself and how you got interested in sustainable living? You've got a lot of background because I can tell from your accent that you didn't start out in Sandpoint.
That is correct. I actually born in Germany. I'm actually Austrian. And I came over to the U.S. 1993, so over 20 years ago. And I got interested in the environmental movement in the 80s. I was living in Berlin when the wall was still up.
Wow.
And actually moved away because of that, and then it fell. So, I had a strong experience where I was like, wow, what can I do? What can I do to be involved in finding ways where we can live without environmental issues? So that was the main topic at that time. Very quickly, I found out about permaculture. I actually had read a book, The One Straw Revolution, from Fukuoka is his name, a Japanese guy. It was very, very interesting and very inspiring. And I had really this strong strong need to do something. Anyway, I found out about permaculture, which is a very inclusive design and approach of how do we create a culture that is sustainable.
Yes, I've done a little research, but not too much. I do have the Permaculture 101 definition for those who would like a one sentence. And what I've read is that permaculture is the philosophy of land use seeking to mimic natural ecologies, maximize food production, and minimize soil erosion. How do you think that one does?
That is how definitely it was in the beginning. That's how permaculture started. Even the name permanent agriculture, that's from those two words put together. Very quickly, actually, I would say it changed really in the permanent culture, which includes also systems that are not land-based, like our social systems, our financial systems, even our governing systems. So the whole aspect, even art, and technology, it includes all these aspects as well, even though permaculture definitely is known of like farming and gardening and those kind of things.
So tell us about the operable scale, if you will. It's easy to see how an individual might practice this, but right. How do communities practice this?
Right. Communities go and if you understand some of the principles how nature works, then you look, how can you apply these in a community? So nature works, for example, with plants that support each other. Same thing you can then mimic in our society, in our communities. Or how do you work together? I mean, are you adversarial or are you wanting to help each other? So the closing the loops in nature is a typical pattern you can find. So the same thing in communities. So we grow up, we share, we learn a lot, we share a lot, become the elders. And then our life cycle is closed, and the same thing with our friends and our communities. So basically, you can base the design of a whole village, of a of an urban, of a town. You can use principles that you find in nature and apply it to our urban environment. You can use it in technology. Like, why not take, like in nature, where biological nutrients cycle, why not create cycles for industrial materials that cycle with itself? And as long as you can keep them from mixing, but you keep them separate, there wouldn't be any issues in terms of pollution. So
yeah, so we're talking about a lot more than mixing my weeds with my carrots.
So are there any good examples of communities who are doing this or attempting to do this, getting closer to it?
Absolutely. I mean, around the world, there's now so many, you could call them eco-villages, intentional communities. I mean, in the U.S., there are many. One of a permaculture example is, I just visited not so long ago on Orcas Island, the Bullock Brothers Homestead Farm. They are one of the probably most developed and well-known examples, at least in the Northwest. And they work in community there. They have always people living there. It's not just them and their families, but they have 10 to 12 people living there. And besides applying it to their lands, I haven't investigated so much. I didn't have the time to talk to everybody there, but they apply some of these ways how nature works within how they work together there. So that's an example.
Was this part of the intent of the Sandpoint Transition Initiative a few years back?
The intent of the Sandpoint Transition Initiative was basically, how can we as a community figure out to provide for our own needs in a sustainable way? And by all means, needs, I mean like, you know, food, water, energy, and then go further into health, economy, and those kind of things. So that was the intention, to do this in a way that's based on permaculture ideas and principles. That's where it's really is built upon. And then as well as applying something I call, you know, the inner ecology, to work together, the inner ecology, like our own personal way of feeling, thinking, being, all that has a strong influence what we actually then put out there in our world. So, and that was part of the transition initiative as well.
And how is that progressing?
Worldwide, I haven't been following so intently in the early times, like 2008 and 9 and 10. It was really thriving here in Sandpoint. It has spread really around the world. I don't know so much like China at this point, but Russia, for example, through this other kind of, you could call them spiritual movement, the Anastasia movement. They really made a big a jump there in bringing in sustainability ideas. And actually, one of my mentors, I would almost say, Sepp Holzer, he has actually done a lot of work in Russia and in East Europe on sometimes huge scale of projects.
Let's talk just a moment about Sepp Holzer, because he's one of the originators, really one of the original thinkers about permaculture, isn't he?
This is really interesting. He never heard this word until maybe 10 years ago and has been developing his parents' farm that he took over like 40 or 50 years ago, and has done something today we call permaculture just by following his childhood experiences and working with the land that he finally convinced his parents, can I have a little piece for myself? And he started like when he was 5 or 6 years old, just watching, observing, and trying out things on his own and then applying it to his farm. And from there, he has such a deep understanding of how nature works, and intuitive understanding, I would say. And also, of course, learned a lot over his lifetime. He has done so many different things on his land, on his farm. And I would say it's one of the best established permaculture examples in Europe.
Yes, and there's another connection that you have with him you're telling me about.
Yes, it was really interesting that I suddenly in 2012 I got a call if I would be interested in translating for Sepp Holzer. And I always wanted to get to know him a little bit better, and I was like, I had planned other things. I was actually going to Europe doing something else, but I changed everything around. And since then, I have been, not this year, but the previous 4 years, I had the opportunity to translate like from English and Austrian German into the other, you know, English or Austrian German. And it was a blast.
I would think so. He's very well known.
Yes, he's very well known. He's an incredible designer. He comes to a piece of land and immediately kind of, I have the feeling he almost visually sees what's possible here, what's good for the land. And he's very, very strongly into tuning into nature and reading the book of nature.
As you've mentioned, you're into systems in general that relate to permaculture. Would mm-hmm. he be more related to the plants and landform part?
Yes. He knows a lot of plants, about plants and plant communities and animals and also the economic part of things. He went through very difficult times economic-wise, like surviving economically. And then at some point, he made kind of the step where he started also showing what he's doing. And then also his ventures, so to say, his farming ventures were very successful.
Well, very interesting person, and I think worth reading if anyone gets a chance. But I was hoping we might move a little bit onto the basics of permaculture, just from the standpoint of gardening.
Right. Yes. I mean, if you do a permaculture garden, so what would that involve? Like everything in permaculture, there's these three ethical, the foundation is like three ethical ideas. One is to care for the planet. One is to care for people. And I would even extend it to all living beings. And then the other one is sharing of, we could say, you know, overflow of abundance that you mm-hmm. may receive with others, with the community. So, which you can totally apply to gardening. Like what we do, sometimes we have so many fruits. We bring them to the food bank. We call our friends. They pick up the boxes. So then there's principles, permaculture principles, which many people that are have been writing about it, teaching for years, have a lot of experience. They all put them together in a different way. One that's most well-known, I would think, is from the co-creator of permaculture, David Holmgreen, who together with Bill Mollison created this whole concept. He wrote a book, and in that book he talks about the 12 principles. And, for example, to observe and to interact is the first principle. So before you do anything, look at your garden plot. Or look at your piece of land, your town lot, and look at it and observe it. What happens? Where is the sun shining? Where is shade coming in? Where is the water running through? Is it coming from the roofs, from the roads, from the sidewalks? Where is the wind coming from? What trees and fences and other things have you around it? Where is noise coming from? Where do you like to look at? So these are the kind of things you can look when you work in your own garden. And then you decide, okay, it seems like for what I want to do, I take this area. Of course, you can design your whole lot like that with those kind of things in mind. So to be able to do this really well, you observe and spend the time to do that.
And not just 10 minutes. I mean, you can look through the seasons, right?
Well, this is one. Yes.
I was going to say, this sounds more or almost like landscape architecture.
It does, but landscape architecture has, I would say, you know, I don't really know landscape architecture. Permaculture has this big view, and you don't need to be a landscape architect to do permaculture. And you can apply landscape architectural skills and knowledge greatly in permaculture in general.
I agree.
Okay. You know something about that subject, right?
That's right.
Other things, for example, so there's these 12 principles and you can read up on them. Another thing I just wanted to mention that's maybe not so much as a principle, it's more like a way of thinking, is when you do things land-based, you want to find ways where you can provide functions by one function by several elements, and one element is giving you several functions. So let's take an example. You probably want to think about how to irrigate your plants. So yes, you can use maybe the city water, right? But you can also collect water from your roofs and use that for watering. So you have at least two systems, and you might want to store in a tank if you have the right size of lot. That might be very feasible to do. So you have different sources of water that then you can use. And of course, you want to use the natural rain and design your system that the soil is rich in humus, and then so it can contain multiple times its volume in water. So these are some of the ways where you have the irrigation or the watering of plants provided by several elements.
I see. So you're working on increasing absorption, so you need less water.
Exactly.
And then finding other sources of water that don't take a lot of energy to... Right.
Absolutely.
Yes, right. Got it.
So if you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY-FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And this morning we're talking with a local sustainable living practitioner, Richard Cadell, about permaculture.
That's right. And for those of you who aren't able to hear all of our show this morning, remember that we do create a podcast. And of course, if you're getting out of range, you can live stream us. Yeah, and so in the midst of things, we're talking about systems and we're talking about design of permaculture, and it's pretty complicated, pretty complex.
Yeah, it sounds like it when you put it in our mental framework, which is sometimes not so much used to circular thinking. I know my background actually is in IT systems design and software development. That I have been doing a lot of times. And interestingly enough, it has helped me in understanding the permaculture system a lot. And also interesting enough, like one thing that's very critical in permaculture understanding is to look for patterns in nature. And actually this whole pattern language idea has been introduced into software development, which is fascinating. Where you find basically the best practices for something and on a software development level and create these patterns. And then actually they start talking about ecosystems in business, right?
Right.
Which comes out of this type of work and these ideas.
That is interesting.
Yes.
So in the mid-80s, you moved to Sandpoint and you have...
Actually living in Germany until 1993.
Oh, 93. Okay.
Yeah. So in Germany, I did all kinds of little projects, starting from experimental permaculture beds in an eco-center. I developed together with a friend of mine an apartment-scale composting toilet. So we designed it. Together and then taught about it. I did a little bit of teaching around water. I visited several eco-villages around the world. The first eco-village that was designed using permaculture principles in Australia, Crystal Waters, and several others also in Europe. Just a handful. Anyway, I was always involved with permaculture, and then I moved to the U.S.
So you were very involved with it before you moved here.
Yes.
What attracted you to the Sandpoint area?
We were traveling. Berta, my wife, and I, we were traveling for 3.5 months, 1 month in Europe, almost stayed there, but then came back, traveled 2.5 years. In the U.S., we had overlaid a lot of different maps in terms of natural resources, issues, and found only certain areas we wanted to visit, and mostly the Rocky Mountain states. And then Idaho was out of the picture. At that time, there were some political groups and stuff happening in the area that we weren't interested in even being exposed to it. And we didn't find anything. We were in lots of smaller towns and areas, and we didn't find anything that spoke to us. We came to Sandpoint and boom.
That's so interesting. And it's a common story, isn't it?
It is a common story.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
That's
and
for
then,
sure.
And then I started here. Basically, I was first living in Boulder, Colorado for 1.5 years. And then we moved here. And already in Boulder, I had started getting interested in straw bale construction and green architectural things. And I helped other folks like building a little bit here and there and consulting a little bit. And then that's what I got involved in here. And then we bought a piece of land, which didn't succeed the way we had set it up. So then we moved actually to town, and I found I could live very sustainable in town versus our lifestyle, our way of living at that point outside of town.
Well, it's interesting because you've been talking about scales of living, and there's the urban scale, and then there's the suburban and rural scale, and then we're talking about other systems too. And you mentioned composting toilets and everything. So it sounds like it's all related to permaculture, such a big concept.
Yes. I think we can apply these ideas out of permaculture, and I'm not saying permaculture is the only way or only place where you find many of these ideas. I think permaculture is unique. First of all, it created this word that's like, oh, what is that? And then it's bringing in from all the different knowledges and disciplines and areas of studies the best practices to create a sustainable system, including our garden or our home and our city life.
So. Right. And, you know, you found the Idaho Panhandle and you found Sandpoint in particular. And was it because you felt it possessed the qualities of the
It was many things. I mean, we had like almost a dozen of things happen that you could call coincidence. But it was speaking to us. And so, I mean, we met people. First of all, the impression of the people living here, we were walking on the sidewalks or going to restaurants. People looked us in the eyes, said hi, and smiled. We did not have that experience in other places. So that was a big thing. Then the beauty. Then before we even were clear that we were going to stay here, people offered us to stay at their place. Other people started looking for a piece of land for us. My wife, she is a health practitioner, and she just was going to get some herbs from somebody else, and they invited them immediately to share the practice space with them. The work we had lined up in Boulder to go, we had the idea, buy something here, go back, work a year in Boulder, come back and build. That fell apart. So there were a number of things where we're like, okay, we get it. And then going over the bridge, and we actually came from Clark Fork the first time, which was on a perfect day, looking down on the lake and this little island and little boats. It was like, is there a town or something around here?
Phil, did the Chamber of Commerce send this guy over here? It sounds like it. Yeah. No, we love Sandpoint, and that's why we have folks like you on, because we all love Sandpoint. Let's get back to the systems around permaculture, and let's talk a little bit more about just about the organic systems and how permaculture would be similar or different from, say, someone planting a conventional garden. I know this is basic permaculture 101, but I think some of our listeners are new to the subject.
Right. So the main idea is really, how can you live sustainable? So how do you apply this to a garden? So in a garden system, besides finding the good areas and locations, considering the microclimate, you consider the connections the garden has very much consciously. They all exist in any type of gardening, basically, except I would say the industrial type of gardening and using chemical, that probably would not fit into my model of sustainability and permaculture.
No, but it's really not the same as just an organic garden. It's not like a 10 by 10 organic. It's really around more than that.
Yeah, it's more than that. I mean, let me put it this way. If you walk into a space on a lot and it's a garden and you feel like in nature, I think you have achieved what I would call a permaculture system or permaculture garden. Now my own garden is not there. It's getting closer, and different areas are closer than others in my garden. So that's the whole thing. And then the relationships between everything. You really, okay, my kitchen compost can go in my garden in different ways. You can use it right for sheet mulching right away. You can use it for a half a continuous building hugelkultur bed by starting one section and then always add at one end and continuously build that, or you have a compost pile. There's different ways to do many of these things that you want to achieve. And compost pile and compost you want because that's what you want for basically as the fertilizer and improving the soils.
Using things that we might normally throw away.
Yes.
And reusing.
Yes, and you can use certain types of cardboard and paper shredded up or torn up or using as a layer for sheet mulching. So you are very conscious, oh, I got something from Amazon and there's a cardboard box. And for me personally, I look, are there staples in there? Is there a lot of colored print on it? Then I take the staples out. I don't use colored print usually. And then flatten it down and can use it in my garden. So you're very conscious about these cycles of nutrients. I personally, I haven't done that, but why not use a composting toilet at home? Which, as far as I know, on the legal level, the regulations, as long as you have a regular sewage system, either to the city sewage or a septic system, you can actually legally have that here. You know, and everybody has different levels of what they're comfortable doing with and what they're not comfortable doing with.
Sure, and I've used a composting toilet, and I've even cleaned one, and they're not that bad. But for those of us who don't know what one is, what is a composting toilet?
Well, a composting toilet is basically a way for your feces and your urine taken care of in a way that it is composting, basically, like a compost pile. So you're adding organic material like sawdust or soil or a mixture of dried leaves and sawdust and the things to provide the environment for your bowel movements to compost. And then what I always recommended in terms of composting toilet, if you have some, there is larger systems where basically when you take out the material, it is smelling like soil. And there are small systems where I would say often it makes sense to compost after that, like mix it in with the regular compost, and that compost then you use not for your food plants or things, but you put it under areas for the flowers, the non-edible things.
Yes, and the advantages of that are we're not using water, right? That's something great.
That's
about
one composting. Of the advantages, and we are not flushing a lot of nutrients and actually inherent energy. Think about all the energy it was taking to actually create this compost that we have in our belly. Basically, the manure we have in our belly, how much energy that could and how many nutrients are in there. We don't flush it with a very valuable resource like water down the drain and ending basically up in a lake or in the ocean or in the rivers or in the soil or in the groundwater.
Well, we're really getting down into the nitty-gritty of it now.
We do. There's many other connections. It's not just the composting toilet.
We're going to leave our listeners with their imagination running on this one. And we're going to take a short musical break here and listen to a little Frank Sinatra, Garden in the Rain. And when we come back, we're going to move away from the toilet, I think, into some other permaculture principles.
So high-minded, Phil.
If you're just tuning in, though, this is 88.5 KRFY in Ponderay, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And we're having a wonderful morning talking about permaculture with Richard Connell. But right now, Frank Sinatra, A Garden in the Rain. Frank Sinatra, Garden in the Rain. Hopefully that didn't put everybody back to sleep, but
we're thinking about rain too much.
Well, it's hard not to fixate a little bit on rain.
That's right. Although rain is an important part of every garden, including permaculture. As those of you who have been listening know, we're here this morning with Richard Connell. He's a sustainable living practitioner who lives here in Sandpoint. We've been having an interesting discussion about the concepts of permaculture and how it's much bigger than just gardening. But let's move to a smaller scale for a moment, Richard. And why don't you tell us about the unique challenges to permaculture, the gardening aspects of it and the systematic aspects of it here in our town. And maybe by starting a little bit with your own experimentation in town.
Right. I have basically two places that I work with. One is our own home. And then one is a apartment complex where we have a edible landscape, really, which is wonderful. I wasn't really involved in establishing it except for sparking the ideas. And now I'm actually involved in maintaining it. Anyway, so Basically, in my home, I have a vegetable garden in the back, and it's interesting. It's kind of almost opposite than where you want to locate it. It's actually furthest away from my home, from my entry door. You really want a garden as close to your kitchen door as possible, especially as things that you need on a day-to-day basis. So it's located furthest away, and the reason is because that's where it's the sunniest spot I have. Even there, I'm starting getting a little bit of a shade issue because there's quite a number of wonderful, lovely high trees around it. Half of them, or maybe a third of them, are actually fruit trees. So it's wonderful to have those in our small city lot. But the shade is shading out some plants or making it a little bit harder to have enough sunshine there. Then I have a little, the planting strip in front of the sidewalk, which is actually city's land. We have half of it, we basically put only native plants, except what the squirrels bury, like black walnuts. And then on the other half, we have berries, which there's a big birch tree that's also giving a little bit more shade than I expected. So, but they're going well. And I have right there in front of our house, I have a strip of garden space too.
So I'm hearing a few things. One is that every garden is a bit of a compromise. We have goals and they don't always work out. And I hear that you're working to produce food for yourself, food yes. that's annual and food that's perennial.
Yeah.
And also working on food and habitat for animals. So it's yes. not just for you.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the most sustainable things that anybody who has, even doesn't have to have land, but you can do it on a balcony, you can do it micro scale on your windowsill, is providing some of your own food. That's one of the most sustainable things we all can go for.
So it seems very natural to be wanting to live in harmony with nature and the beings around it. But how do you live in harmony with the moose that wander into town?
Well, actually, we are famous for having moose in our backyard sitting. And see this very simple example. We have an apple tree. That apple tree is so high, we don't prune. Normally, I might because it's creating some issues, old limbs and all that. But anyway, so we can't harvest all, or we don't harvest all. And sometimes very consciously, we let them fall. So then the snow comes and suddenly the moose show up. And what do? They find the apple under the snow and eat it. So we're actually providing food for wild animals. And the moose in town, they became very used to...
Habituated.
Yes. To folks being around as long as they're respectful. And we had like the mama moose with the two little kids hanging out there for hours. And then the manure, I put in my special compost pile. Because it's lying on the grass the next spring and then clean it up.
Careful about the manure. We're not getting back
there. Okay. So you can deal with the wildlife in that sense. We had raccoons a lot in the area. And then one neighbor, she decided to get traps and she trapped them and worked with the wildlife rescue service together. Mm-hmm. And then they brought them far out of town.
Sandpoint, unlike some communities, will allow folks in town to raise chickens and yes. I've had a friend whose chickens met an unfortunate demise a few months ago, and they weren't sure if it was a neighbor's dog or raccoons or some other critter. Mm-hmm. So even in town, there's these complex issues of yes. how do you live in harmony with
right.
wildlife and right. with the production of your own food.
Right. I mean, one typical thing you might run to is slugs, especially if some of the things that I'm doing in my gardening system where I use a lot of mulch, in some sense, I always... Let me put it this way. I try to have, even except if I have special purposes, always have soil covered, never bare soil, always. And so you might run into an issue of slug, banana slug. And I have to say, I was wondering, I have been collecting sometimes when I started my seedlings or my seeds and stuff. So I went out during the night and collected quite a few, or when I was working on the garden. And it has found its balance.
Collecting slugs?
Not collecting slugs. I was collecting slugs to remove them from the plant.
I see.
And then I killed them and composted them.
So they did re-enter
I have slugs, but there's a balance now somewhere. And I'm not quite sure who are the predators that I have or what happened exactly. But I have a balance so that today, like the last 2 years, I had some damage from slugs in my salads and here and there and young seedlings. but nothing that would have really be a real big issue. So they fulfill their role, of course, the slugs. They have certain things they eat and they're really good. So that's a wildlife too.
Yes. Right.
Some birds. Yeah. We have birds. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we have, what are they, the crows and red robins. And sometimes they come in big swarms. And that can be a problem in terms of a fruit tree, for example. So far, I haven't had to do anything, but I've been observing it. And like the red robins, some of the apples, they're really high. They get really brown when they hang there till spring. Then the red robins come and they clean them all off. So it's food for the wildlife.
Right, and not a mess for you then.
Not a mess for me, right.
So you've been teaching these principles to others since you've been here. Are there some right. good examples? Are there students locally of yours or others that you've collaborated with?
Yeah, there are people. All the names and all the places, that's some tough for me. But there are people, there is at least one or two dozens of people, either Sandpoint or surrounding area. Many mm-hmm. of them I know, they are rural, they have acreage. And actually we taught some classes together with some folks on some acreages out of town in Kokolala. I know somebody who has a place in Priest River. They're designing more like Holzer permaculture ways, but they also live in town at the same time. So there are people, there is the Prepared Homestead is one that actually has a website and publishes they doing permaculture. There's quite a number of people that have started, and some of them have definitely put something in place.
And it really is a learning process. I'm hearing that.
Definitely. I mean, the thing is that you try to build a foundation with permaculture principles, the ethical foundation, and then go through different climate scenarios. There's a zone and sector design system, zoning basically all the energies like wind, water, sun, how it runs through your property, how can you use it as much as possible on your land. That's the sectoring. And the zoning is much more how much energy do you expend to visit an element in your system. The more you visit it, the closer to the home. These kind of things in background, you can design.
So if someone's listening and the light bulb's gone off in their head and they say they want to find out more, what resources are there for
There's some good publications. One of them, on the gardening scale, is definitely called Gaia's Garden from Toby Hemingway. One other thing we haven't really talked about a lot, but one big difference is in the regular gardening is that very consciously we use perennial foods, not just plants like bushes and flowers for beauty, which is also definitely part of it, but perennial food plants and perennial systems, or how perennializing you can do it, or reseeding or self-seeding vegetables you can use, and how all that works. So there's a book, Perennial Vegetables, from Eric Tunsmeyer. That's one of the first that came out like that. There's a very basic book, Introduction to Permaculture, which is quite aged, but I think it's still great. It's Bill Mollison with Serena Meyer Slay. That's also Australian-based a little bit more. And then another very well-known tome in landscaping actually is from Robert Carrick, Your Edible Landscape Naturally. With a certain foundation and even reading some of these things, you can take courses. There are courses taught all over the place. You just, Google permaculture course on something and you can find that. There are two magazines. One is the Permaculture Design Magazine, which is a advanced level, not usually often. And then there's a new one that's called Permaculture North America that just was published in Europe and UK for a long time, but they now started publishing here. Other resources, yeah. I mean, I'm always interested in talking to somebody who is interested in permaculture. I have been helping a few people setting up
some places. And so what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
Phone number is the best, or my email address. So my email address is richard@gentleharvest.org. And my phone number is 208-255-2440.
And we have a bit of time left. And Richard, I'd like to just ask you to go through an example for me. Say someone's
decided this sounds like a great idea. And let's say they live in town and they really haven't done very much yet. We've already talked about observing, but this fall, what are some things they might think about doing? And we just have a couple minutes, but what would be a good way to get started?
I would say you can now set up your compost pile. It's one thing you can do, and then it can ripen through the winter. You can plant a few things. One of them definitely would be garlic.
And it's not too late for garlic.
No.
Good.
No. I think actually what happens in a permaculture garden, often you let certain plants go to seed so they can self-seed. And if you think about how nature works, the seeds fall, or the fruits fall, or the nuts fall on the surface, right? And then they work their way maybe into the mulch and the leafy and whatever is on the ground, and they sprout and grow. So we can mimic these kind of things, and that's what permaculture is all about. How is nature doing it? How can we do this in our garden, in our office, in our home, wherever, on our farm? So that's one thing I think you can think about. What do you want to eat? What are you eating? So what kind of seeds do I need to find or want to get seedlings? Let's see, you can think about where would be a good place for your garden. So you can look in the season now, where is it really waterlogged? Where is it dry? Where is it shady and sunny at this time of the year? You can still harvest actually now. I'm harvesting now if you have had a garden. I just harvested carrots, for example, or Jerusalem artichokes. So you can do harvesting now, and you can also cover things that you want to harvest throughout the winter. With the snow cover on top, it's actually isolated pretty well, but I would put a big pile of mulch on top of my carrots, for example, and then you can harvest throughout the winter. You can think about the energies running through your property. You know, where's the sun, the shade, the water? Is there kind of some sort of flooding sometimes when little puddles overflow? Are there frost pockets? Where's the wind coming from? What do I have on site already? What kind of plants? Do they provide mulch? Do they provide like little stakes, like wood stakes? What kind of tools do I have? What kind of tools do I need? You don't need a lot. Just a trowel, a shovel, gloves, a bucket, buckets. That's really easy to start and doesn't cost a lot of money. You can think about, you still can lay out where you want to make your bed by using, for example, ropes or sticks or a garden hose. And just put on the ground where you think to have your garden beds and your passes and all
it
that.
It would help observe, I would think.
Yeah, and then you can see,
where's the sun?
This is not so good to have my path here. And the other thing is, right now you can store, harvest, store, process.
Yeah, well, that's a lot to think about. Richard, we're just about running out of time, so we're going to finish our interview and thank you. Is there anything you'd like to sum up with?
I think... as much as we can tune into what nature is and how nature works, some of that might be on very much beyond a mental or rational level. We find the beauty and our affinity that we are actually part of nature and live accordingly. I think that's what I'm looking for in my life and have great joy with that.
Well, that's a great way to end. I want to thank you for joining us.
Those are great words to live by. Even if we don't perfect it, just the practice of getting there makes us all better.
That's right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for having me here.
For those of you who are just joining us, we've just been speaking with Richard Kuhnel. He's a sustainable living practitioner, and you are listening to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported radio, community radio for North Idaho. And
we're going to listen to a little Bob Dylan, our latest Nobel Prize in Literature recipient. He's going to do his version of Buckets of Rain. Then after that, we'll be back, and we'll talk a little bit about upcoming events. Bob Dylan, Buckets of Rain. Of course, it's the rain that makes the gardens grow.
Until they're flooded, which could happen.
Yeah, well, we can use it. The ground still is soaking it all up at my place.
It seems to be.
So if you've enjoyed this morning's morning show, you can tune in every Tuesday and hear Julie and I. And as she mentioned earlier, it's available as a podcast. If you're out of town, you can go to krfy.org for live streaming. This is KRFY in Ponderate, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. The morning show continues tomorrow with the local decision 2016. I think it's the last of the actual debate discussion shows.
That's right. And then the election after that. So vote, everyone.
Tomorrow we have Senate 1 Senate seat. Invited guests include Sean Keogh and Steve Tanner. So tune in to hear their stand on important issues. That's at 8 o'clock at 88.5 KRFY with show hosts Susie Perez and Chris Bessler. Then on Thursday, we have the morning show with Jack Peterson. He always has some great community guests on. And next Tuesday, I'll be gone. Julie will be holding down the fort, but we'll be broadcasting a pre-recorded interview with folks from the National Forest Foundation talking about the treasured landscapes and their projects here in North Idaho, including Adam Liljeblad, Emily Olson, and the local Sandpoint Area District Ranger for the U.S. Forest Service, Eric Walker.
And don't worry, we'll still keep you up to date on the weather and current events. So it'll be an interesting show, and I know you're going to appreciate hearing that.
What events do we have coming up?
Well, we have a few, Phil, and kind of interesting ones. Today, if you'd like to join them, you can go to North Idaho Forage and Grazing School. North Idaho Forage and Grazing School is sponsored by the University of Idaho Extension. That's going to be, well, you know what? You might have missed it. It's today from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. I'm moving on. Tomorrow, you can join the Inventors Association of Idaho with their monthly meeting. That's at the Columbia Bank Building, 414 Church Street. And that's a monthly meeting. It will be at 2 p.m. November speaker is Sandpoint attorney Doug Marks, and he will be speaking on the hot topic for entrepreneurial inventors, which is legally protecting your intellectual property through a complex supply chain. Does that sound like permaculture? Not sure. And then moving on the 5th, we're going to be having the Sandpoint Film Festival. That's at the Panada. We all know that's at 300 North 1st Avenue, and they're hosting the Sandpoint Film Festival with Block 1 starting at 11, Block 2 at 3, and Block 3 at 6 p.m. The kickoff Friday night with a filmmaker's welcome at Trinity at City Beach. That begins at 4:30.
There's always so much going on. There's a lot of stuff on Saturday. The Sassy Harvest Dinner, Sandpoint Area Senior Senator, they're hosting a harvest dinner at 5 o'clock featuring locally raised pork, salad, potatoes, beans, and dessert. It's a fundraiser. You can get more information at 208-263-6860.
And Phil, tell us about something you and I are both going to be doing.
Well, Saturday morning, rain or shine, we're going to go down to Dog Beach and pull some flowering rush because it feels so good to pull the weeds out of the water. If you want to join us, that's at 9 a.m. It's sponsored by the Bonner County Soil and Conservation District and the Lakes Commission. Show up at 9 a.m. with your rubber boots, gloves, a 5-gallon bucket, and expect to get a little muddy.
It's fun. Plan on joining us. You'll get to meet Phil and me if you come. And then finally on the 5th, if you're interested in a little music, you can listen to Bringing It Back to the Blues. That's at McDuff's Beer Hall at 220 Cedar. It's all about the blues. And you'll be listening to Kevin Doran, for those who know him. Mm-hmm. For more info, you can call 208-209-6700.
Saturday night is also the Community Cancer Services big fundraiser, the annual event, A Night to Remember. I know that's one of their largest events of the year and one of the most important to funding the continuing services that they provide for cancer patients. It's at the Bonner County Fairgrounds at 5:30. It features a 4-course dinner catered by Dish. Each course is paired with a wine featuring Coeur d'Alene Cellars, Small House, Clearwater Canyon, and Pondere Winery, all local wineries. So we're on that topic today. There'll be a silent auction, dessert, and a live auction, as well as a wine pool.
That's three different things that night. I guess we'll have to pick, Phil.
Yeah, well, we'll divide and conquer.
There you go.
What else is going on, Julie?
A couple more things for those of you who are photo folks. Be on the 2nd, which is tomorrow. We have the Sandpoint Photo Club. That's at Sandpoint Library. And they're hosting the Photo Club at 5 p.m. You can learn and share with other photographers. That's always held on the first Wednesday of the month.
So this has been a great morning show on Tuesday. Again, join us every Tuesday and join our co-hosts for the other morning shows, Wednesdays and Thursdays, always at 8 a.m. here at KRFY 88.5, listener-supported radio for North Idaho. We're going to go out with a little Elton John, his number one song that started a number one run in 1975, Julie.
Island girl, send me to an island, would you?
All right. It sounds good. Here he is.